in Cambridge at the Broad Institute with Pardis Sabiti, who is an evolutionary biologist at Harvard Center for Systems Biology. I was just looking at a report of something from your lab. It says researchers from Harvard University have come up with a method for refining their view of recent signals of natural selection in the human genome. In this 200th anniversary year of Charles Darwin, that seems like a nice appropriate topic, but could you explain what on earth that means?
Sure. So that is work that we just recently presented at the American Society of Human Genetics. And my lab works on developing methods to detect signals of evolution in the genome. And mostly we've been working in the human genome, trying to identify places in the genome where something interesting has occurred, where a new mutation has spread rapidly through a population. The kinds of mutations I'm talking about are things like sickle cell anemia that protects from malaria that spread within the last 10,000 years in Africa, or lactose tolerance, the mutation that allows you to drink milk, that spread within the last 10,000 years in European populations and actually also African populations, or populations in which where cattle were domesticated. So there are lots of mutations that we can see that have had some sort of a beneficial effect and have spread through populations. And we design computational methods to go through the genome and try to identify those.
This is some of the papers that, as I look at them here, help us get familiar with this sort of language as well. You talk about the genome. I think people know that there's been a human genome project. But there's also this other project called the HapMap, haplotype mapping. And here's an example of one of the papers that you're on, a high-resolution HLA and SNP haplotype map for disease association studies in the extended human MHC. So what we're talking about is human leukocyte antigens. We're talking about the major histocompatibility complex of humans and so on. And we're talking about SNPs. But would you now give me a dummy's guide to what I just said?
Oh, okay. Well, so that's got a lot of... there's a lot of specifics in that paper.
Let's start with what HapMap is.
Okay, sure. So after the genome was sequenced, so there were kind of stages in which the human genome has been studied. The first step was just sequencing the genome of one individual to try to find out what is in the genome and what is generally in the genome of humans. And so basically there's 3 billion letters or nucleotides that make up the human genome. And they with a very large scale project, went through and got that baseline architecture. What are the genes that make up the genome? What is the general consistency of the genome? And then once that project got underway, they next moved to just sequencing more individuals to try to characterize variation. So different people are different. So what are the different, what they call polymorphisms in the genome? So generally, everybody shares the same 3 billion nucleotides letters, but there are places in which there are differences. So then we started to, the community started to characterize all of those variations and those polymorphisms.
So just to interject there, SNP means single nucleotide polymorphism.
Yeah, so polymorphism just means a region of the genome where there are differences of some sort. So polymorph from Greek would be many forms. So places where there are many forms, and there are different kinds of polymorphisms that exist. And a common one and a very easy one to study are single nucleotide polymorphisms, a place where there was just one single change that occurred of a nucleotide from adenine to a guanine would be an A to a G change, different kinds of changes like that where a single mutation at a single site will make a difference. But there are lots of different kinds of polymorphisms, both small and large.
Okay, and the reason for doing this, the rationale, the mission of all of this enterprise?
Sure. So the HapMap project, and what that means is essentially that as they started characterizing all these polymorphisms, they realized there was a structure to it, that there are basically only certain ways that we generate diversity, and because of it, through one is mutation and another one is recombination, which is sort of reshuffling the background the different mutations lie on, and that the human population is pretty closely related, and there is a lot of structure that'll help you understand the genome. So if you characterize one part of the genome, you might know something about another. So the haplotype map is describing these connections between different parts of the genome and characterizing both the variation and the structure that exists in the human genome.
Okay, so you have been finding that these changes have happened, the ones that you're interested in, have been happening recently.
Well, I guess to actually turn that, I look for recent changes. So it's not that there are many different types of evolution that you can study, and each of them requires a lot of effort. So I've focused on identifying genome changes that have happened in the last, say, 30,000 years.
Okay. And particularly some of these, you've been working on Lassa fever, mm-hmm. which is a Lassa virus, mm-hmm. and so on. This is a disease. Could you talk
sure.
a bit about
so,
that?
Sure. So, you know, when you scan the human genome and you look to see what kind of changes occurred, and I mentioned that a lot of malaria resistance variation has recently spread in human populations, so resistance to getting malaria has been under strong evolutionary pressure. As well as lactose tolerance, as well as changes in pigment, lightening skin as humans moved into colder and darker climates. But there are lots of signals that we scan and we detect, and we don't know what they do. So we have a whole array of these regions, and now with this new method, mutations that we believe to be strongly under strong selection and critical for the survival of the human species that we're trying to investigate. And so by the method that we've developed, the very strongest signal of selection in the West African population we were studying, which are the Yoruba from Nigeria, is in a gene that's critical for Lassa virus and for other arena viruses. And this is a class of viruses that are not very well known, but as it turns out, in West Africa, there are hundreds of thousands of infections a year. And the Minister of Health, the numbers change because it's not very well studied and there's not a lot of infrastructure to study it. But, you know, the belief is thousands, if not tens of thousands. I think now the Minister of Health in Nigeria believe maybe 50,000 deaths a year from this virus. So really, that's a moving target. We don't know the number. But we know that hundreds of thousands of people are being infected a year of this virus.
Okay, does this have any connection at all? I mean, obviously people are very worried at the moment about all sorts of viruses, mm-hmm. and so on. Does your work impact directly on the notion of global infectious diseases?
For sure, actually. So something about Lassa. So again, I only myself, I went to medical school, and really you're not taught. This is not a virus that comes up. People hear of Ebola, they hear of smallpox and bubonic plague. Lassa virus is in the same category of agents as those, in that it's category A. You have to be in a spacesuit, BL4 facility to work in it because it has the potential to go airborne and is deadly very rapidly. But it's not very well studied. The things about it that you should know and that I learned as I began to study is that it is very widespread, it is very deadly, and it is actually the most common. So Ebola, there's never been infections outside of Africa. And even when, you know, the finger stick happened, there was no known infection, there was not cases. Lassa is the most commonly exported virus outside of Africa. There have been at least 34 cases and 2 deaths in the last year in England due to Lassa virus. So there are many infections that go on. So it is a definite global health threat.
Okay. In terms of, I'm just looking at this cover of Discover magazine that was mm-hmm. earlier this year. The story says, "Are we still evolving?" Mm-hmm. There's a school of thought that thinks we've stopped evolving. I mean, uh-huh. even a geneticist like Steve Jones at University College London would say that mm-hmm. I think he said something like, "This is utopia. We've reached it. That's the end."
Huh. Okay.
And yet, as you know, Henry Harpending, John Hawkes, Greg Cochran have done some papers. A book came out recently called The 10,000-Year Explosion, mm-hmm. suggesting that there's still fairly considerable evolutionary shifting going on, mm-hmm. Natural selection going on, mm-hmm. even during the last 10,000 years. Is mm-hmm. this something that you could speak to as well?
So yes, we're still evolving. Evolution is just, it's a continual process. Whether we know how or not, whether we understand what's happening, evolution is every generation, changes are made. And so it's how dramatic those changes are is to be seen. But changes are always occurring. And definitely in the last 10,000 years, a lot of changes have occurred. For sure then. I mean, one of the things, I respect TARP and Ding a lot in the work that they do. I mean, the argument they make, they try to address, but the methods are still better at detecting recent evolution. So one of the statements they make is, we've evolved more rapidly in the last 10,000 years. That I don't know, because honestly, the methods are more powerful in the recent time. And so it's just the signal of evolution starts to drift away over time, and so it's harder to understand things that have happened in the past. So whether we're evolving, I absolutely agree with whether evolving more rapidly, that's a question that remains to be seen.
Yeah, because in a summary about this is, I'm looking at Scientific American now from January of 2009, a piece by Peter Ward, What Will Become of Homo Sapiens. Mm-hmm. He mentions the Harpending studies and then follows on mentioning a study by you, mm-hmm. Using huge data sets of genetic variation to look for signs of natural selection across the human genome. More than 300 regions on the genome showed evidence of recent changes that improved people's chance of surviving and reproducing. Mm-hmm. That's accurate?
That is accurate, yeah. So, I mean, yeah, there have been, there are many mutations that we've identified in recent time. And some of them we understand well, and many of them we're yet to understand. But
how do some of these work? I mean, given that you mentioned things like hair and sweat and diameters of hair and sweat glands and so on and so forth, I mean, how does this all fit into surviving?
Okay. It's a good question. I mean, things like malaria, people understand, right? There's an infectious disease, it kills you if you get it, and so individuals who have a mutation that protects them from it are more likely to survive and reproduce and pass on that mutation to their children, and then their children are more likely to do the same and pass it on to their children's children. And through that process, that mutation will spread. Other ones are obviously more contentious. So lactose tolerance even confuses some people because it's the ability to drink milk. And so why would that be such a survival pressure? And also, people seem to think that lactose tolerance sounds like a disease, so that would be the new thing that lactose intolerance sounds like a disease, so that would be the new thing. But actually, when I explain it, I say, well, all mammals drink milk. That's kind of one of the definitions of mammals, is that we drink milk, and that's sort of pervasive through the mammalian lineage. But all mammals drink milk until a period in which they wean from their mother's milk and then move on to other sources. And at that point, there makes no sense to keep an enzyme going to digest something that you don't get. And that makes sense in a historical time frame of why it would be advantageous for the child to stop drinking milk, because the mother does not want to give milk to the child into adulthood for various, you can think, like, socially that would be awkward at 25 if your son kept drinking your milk. But actually, on a very serious point, it's that you would continue to drink, use your mother's resources. And then there's very direct links between ovulation and lactation, basically. As you're giving milk, you don't have the resources to begin having another child, so you're not going to ovulate and things like that. So back in that time frame, it makes sense that essentially you only would drink your mother's milk until you're able to go and find other resources. As soon as we domesticated cattle, everything changes, because now it's not a burden to the mother if you continue to drink milk into adulthood. And so individuals who drink milk now have a very different food source that other people can't exploit at all. What effect does that then have long term? It actually increases you have a new source of water. So in times of drought, you have a source of food. In times of famine, you have, and you also generally have a source of fat, which is very important for, we've seen in the industrial age where when we have more fat in our diets and calories in our diets, that menarche, the age of, girls getting their period drops. So the faster you can actually build up your food sources and your fat sources, the sooner you'll start to be able to have children. And so individuals who probably were lactose tolerant and could drink milk probably had, on average, one or two more children than other people. That's how evolution works. You know, people think about it as death and things like that, but actually reproduction is just as important to that. And so if you have more children or you're more likely to survive in pregnancy or any of that kind of stuff will also be very important.
How did you get into science? What's the story of this?
I think I was always into science. that as a child, my favorite subject was math, for sure. It's what I always did. I did all those kind of, you know, I did all the math in class and then continued to do it and all the sort of puzzles and all those different games and Olympiads and things like that. I've just always been really excited about solving puzzles. And
You're now in Iran, right?
This
is
no,
when you were growing up, or you left when you were...
I left Iran at the age of 2.5.
All right. So were your parents, did they have any science background?
Or they don't. I mean, it's, you know, it's one of those things where before women work, it's hard to say what would my mother have been, but she might have been a scientist. She has a very, you know, she likes science a lot. My dad has a very analytical mind. He was a lawyer and a judge, you know, but he did a lot of, he was a professor and did work in logic and things like that. So he, and my sister is also an attorney. So we have a lot of logic and analytic type, but I'm the only scientist in the family,
and
in the immediate family.
Came to the States when you were 2.5?
Yeah, so to date myself, I came in the October of 78.
Right.
Yeah.
And the science emerges at roughly what age, do you think?
Probably 5 or something like that.
Oh, so you were already getting interested then? Yeah,
for sure. So it was funny because I sort of tell this story, which is that we came to America and I didn't have the kind of resources. We didn't, you know, like other American students, we didn't know about summer camps or, you know, there's sort of like opportunities outside of school. We just went to the regular public school. But the one thing that did happen was that my mom had the idea to have my sister teach me school in the summer. So basically, you know, I guess to keep us both occupied, she made this whole summer camp feeling where she bought a lot of books and we'd read them and we had a whole like schedule of work. And she kind of gave my sister the authority to teach me in the summer and got a chalkboard. And my sister took this to heart and created an entire curriculum. And one of the big things is she always taught me 2 years ahead of, or you know, 2 years ahead of time, all of the math. That was an easy one for her to teach me. And so I always learned math 2 years ahead of when the schools were teaching it. And I would say that the things that instilled in me is, well, I started doing all these like math puzzles and the, you know, the multiplication tables, and she started teaching me algebra and all sorts of things. And so when I went to school, I always knew everything before the whole curriculum for the whole year by the time I got there. And so I just got really into trying to be perfect at it. So when we did the times tables or whatever, I would try to do them in double time and all that kind of stuff. So it was interesting because I never thought then, oh, maybe I should skip a grade. That was never in my, I wasn't precocious like that. I just thought I'm supposed to do this, but I didn't get bored. I just kind of tried to do it as best as possible. So I would say actually that my sister, I would say my mom and my sister in that kind of combo are probably like the greatest, you know, they did so much for me by giving me that early start and making me really excited about doing things well.
And then how does it go from there? You apply for...
And then basically I think in seventh grade I was in my math class. They showed a video of the 270 competition, which was MIT has this kind of a storied competition, which in this mechanical engineering class there's a design where there's some activity and there's a competition where people build robots that do things. And I basically fell in love with MIT from that competition, from a video of it that my math teacher showed me. And it just became the place I wanted to go.
Okay, now I spoke earlier in the week to Cynthia Brazil, mm-hmm. who obviously does work with robots.
But yep.
You're not working with robots.
You took
a left turn somewhere. What happened?
No, it wasn't actually necessarily the working with robots that got me excited about it. It was just in most places in the United States, there's not an obsession with school. And frankly, the fact that you do school is the thing that you do that is your social suicide, right? You do it kind of secretly or whatever. It's not embraced. And what I saw in the video was a bunch of people who were having fun and excited about building something or creating something. And so I think I just saw my people. I saw that video and I said, I want to be there. I want to be in a place in which people are just excited about building things and making things and doing stuff like that. So, I think that's what it was. I think it was just I really resonated with the excitement that they felt to be doing something scholastic, I guess.
But where did you go from there?
So basically, you know, my senior year in college, I went to one of the MIT things and I fell in love and I came and visited and I absolutely loved the place. It's just a place in which people just are just very creative and excited and not competitive, just very excited to all participate. So I came here, and I think my senior year also I took in my AP biology class, I had an incredible teacher who got me incredibly excited about biology, and came here, and Eric Lander was my undergraduate advisor. So I think I just had a series of events that told me biology is where I wanted to be, which is a little bit of a turn because actually I'm not a very good biologist. So math and that technical stuff is where I really enjoy, but actually biology I'm not those kinds of the biology itself is not my best area, but somehow in genetics I found that perfect place in which I'm applying mathematics to biological questions or to just the natural world in a way that was very exciting.
Eric Lander, of course, is now co-chair of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. Mm-hmm. So there's a connection there between science and politics. Do you have any interest in the science and society issues?
I have interest in it, but someone like Eric, Eric is, you know, when I saw that happened and that he was picked to be a presidential advisor, I thought that's beautiful. It gave me more respect for Barack Obama for making that decision. He is the kind of person I want in charge and responsible and thinking about that. He has a great global view and just is incredible. I enjoy it, but I don't think that necessarily that's where I'm actually best. I think for some reason everyone's always thought I should go into policy. I'd actually just do best, you know, at the table solving small problems and things like that. So it's not necessarily, I think, one of my strengths. Eric actually is just extraordinary. David Altshuler, who also works here at the Broad and very closely, he's extraordinary. I see people who think very well about how to deal with a lot of these policy issues. And I would enjoy it, but I don't necessarily think, at least for now, it's something where I have a great strength.
Yeah, we've talked about this, about your having been at some of these L'Oreal and the Women's Global Forum and so on. There seems to be a shift in that over time here, and I'm almost beginning to think I should retire this question about women in science, uh-huh, and how big an issue that is and so on. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not as big an issue as it was anymore. What's your sense of having gone through this process? Do you still feel that there needs to be some sort of advocacy to get more women into science?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, actually. I don't think you need to retire that question. It's
okay.
A good question. It shifts as to what, I think now opportunities for women in science are there.
Yeah.
Motivation for women in science is not, I would say, more. And of course, there are always issues. It is difficult. There are challenges. The academic lifestyle is not one that is very conducive to having a family. So there are all sorts of things that you deal with, and sometimes the PhD is not conducive to having a life, even, you know. So there are definitely things to think about in the context of, however we shift, and definitely there's been some incredible shifts in the culture around gender issues. But at the same time, there are just some things that are biological and that can't be changed. Right? Is that when you're pregnant, when you have a child, there are issues. And so I think there's a lot that still needs to be done on that front. But the bigger problem, and it's not really just for women, I think it's for children right now, is motivation for a career in science and for a life in science, is that too many kids today don't really see why it would be exciting to have a career in science and are discouraged away from it early on. I think it's actually what's happening in the education system that we need to think about. I sometimes actually just talk about, when I talk about America, I love America, I'm happy to be here, I embrace it, I'm all red, white, and blue. But what is interesting about the culture is that it's a culture in which the word cool is such a defining word. It's what everybody wants to be, right? Everybody wants to be cool, and we're a culture of, in the high schools you have prom kings and homecoming queens and all of this kind of stuff, and it's all about defining who is the most cool person at your school. And what defines that is being good at certain things, right? Being funny, being good looking, being good at sports is a big one. Being good at most anything except for school, education, academics, smart. And I just think that that's actually, there are other cultures like it, but it's a very distinctly American thing in which, you know, there is the nerd, the distinctive nerd. Everything where you're scholastically interesting in any way is a negative to your how you perform in the society. You're more likely to get beaten up, for sure. So if that's the predictor. And so I think that that's actually a broader problem. And I think women are in that age are very, there's a lot of bullyism that happens and things like that. So I think they are often discouraged. And when I was kind of touring around interviewing for what school I was going to be a professor at. And it was very funny. The number of times someone would pull me aside and said, can you just go talk to my daughter? She's now, in seventh grade and she's performing badly and she's afraid that it's going to make her, you know, she's very conscious of being popular and she just thinks that being in the math club is going to be a disaster. And so, I mean, people are just going around saying, you're in a rock band, just talk to her. Just tell her that you're normal, please. That's a big problem. I just think a lot of girls are very discouraged away from pursuing being smart and being appreciated for that.
All right, so let's pick up the two things there. You mentioned the rock band thing. Mm-hmm. I also read somewhere that you were thinking of doing music videos to persuade children to go into science. Mm-hmm. Let's deal with the rock band thing.
Okay.
My friend Neil Tyson introduced mm-hmm. a segment of Nova Science Now, dressed like Jimi Hendrix, introducing you precisely because you are, as the lyric says, the singer in the band, mm-hmm. Lead singer of A Thousand Days.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen? How did the music start?
So it started, I would say, generally late. My mom actually really tried hard to get us to play piano as kids and things like that, but somehow it just didn't happen. I never really got into music, and I didn't play anything. As a kid,
Did your sister play?
No, actually, I think she was the one who really didn't like us having piano. So I'd say my sister. We just didn't like. It was just somehow it was like an extra. It was one of those things where you get so tired and there's another thing you have to do, and so we just didn't. We didn't really. And we also moved around. There was different reasons why we just never did it, and it wasn't something that was. I don't know. I didn't think of. Point being, we would joke. My sister and I would joke around because we'd always be preparing the song the minute before the woman came to. Somehow we just didn't take it seriously. So these things happen. But the funny thing is that I was very always obsessed with music. I kind of was in seventh grade. I somehow picked up New Order, Substance, and from that day. Indie rock became this obsession of mine, and so I just started listening to indie rock all the time, and generally just was always very obsessed with music. And so I've been listening my whole life, but I'd never actually played, and I remember in high school thinking, gosh, I think guitar is what I really would have wanted to play. Maybe it's just I didn't want to do piano or something, and I wish I'd learned it in when I was a kid. It's too late for me. And then I got to college, and I was like, I wish I'd learned it in high school. It's too late for me. And then I got to grad school, and I thought, I wish I learned it in college. It's too late for me. And then I had two friends in grad school who, actually Taylor Antrim, who's a novelist, and Bruce Hickey, an attorney, that were both students with me in Oxford. And they were always fantasy banding and kind of riffing on their guitars. We all were obsessed with the same bands. And they kept talking about forming a band, and I said, just do it. Why don't you just do it? And they said, well, we need a rhythm section. You can't have a band without at least a bass. And so the next day, Bruce took me to the store, and I bought a bass, and I just started learning on the fly.
So you're in Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship at this mm-hmm. point. Where were you?
With New College.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. And so you go into Oxford, mm-hmm. buy a guitar, and...
There it is. Yeah. So yeah, it was pretty. It was amazing. It was just amazing. It's funny. We still talk about it as the glory days. For some reason, that band actually had a similar name to my new band, but it was called 1001 Moose. It was a ridiculous band, and we didn't ever do any covers. We just started writing right away. Bruce and Taylor had tons and tons of songs. They'd been waiting to be in a band their whole lives, basically. And we had a lot of friends. We were all at New College. And we just kept playing. Actually, pretty much we did the whole New College circuit where we played in the bar, then we played in the common room and all, but we just started playing all the time.
So did you in fact go ahead, and are you still working on this thing about doing music videos for kids, or what?
So the idea is actually that I essentially said that I want to kind of do music videos and then have it be where there are random scientists that are in them. Not necessarily, I don't really like the idea of saying, again, probably because I myself am worried about being cool, would not want to make it a corny science video or something like that. I would actually just want it where it's an edgy video in which there happens to be somebody who's a scientist, right? So I got the idea because I was I'm friends with Marvin Minsky, and one day I was just sort of looking at Marvin and saying, that guy is, he's got something. And I would think that any rock video, if Marvin Minsky, he's such an edge to it, you know, he's got such a great look, and I thought, I want Marvin in one of my videos. So I emailed him in the middle of the night and said, Marvin, would you be in one of my videos? And he responded within half an hour, sure, you know. And so I started thinking, I want to try to, I'm waiting for Marvin to try to take him up on that offer before I can really get, I have some ideas of some real directors that I would want to come in and do something. So if I can at some point convince Michel Gondry, that was my obsession. You know, in your fantasy, I fantasy band as well, I fantasy world. If I could convince Michel Gondry to do a video, I would put Marvin Minsky in it. I think it would be fantastic.
His last one was on sleep, wasn't it?
In my dream world. Yeah, no, exactly.
Well, sleep and dreams.
I think, yeah, I mean, you know when you get it where Michel Gondry often comes to MIT, so I might.
You also have a very good edgy composer around the corner at MIT's Media Lab in Todd Machover.
So oh, yeah, for sure.
You should ask Todd.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yes. Well, yeah, Todd has actually. Todd and I met a while back, and he's been fantastic. He's been really fun to talk to. He actually was someone who took a chance on me when I was in med school and introduced me to Andy Hong, who is one of his former students, who was one of the founding inventors at DigiDesign that did all the Pro Tools and has a few studios in New York. Is incredible. So because of Todd, actually, Andy and I have become very good friends, and Andy produced my last song.
So did I miss something, or hasn't there been a rise of the geeks? I mean, Marvin would be cool, but also geeky. I mean,
well, in certain circles, in Cambridge, there's a rise of the Greeks, but I would say maybe in LA, I think there's the rise of Lindsay Lohan, Paris Hilton, and that crew, right? I think in our little world here, we think it's very cool to be a geek, and that's actually why Cambridge to me was utopia. Because it's a place in which that's really embraced.
Yeah. So one of the questions I often ask people is, if you hadn't been a scientist, what else would you do? Mm-hmm. And over and over again, very frequently, the answer is, I always wanted to be a musician. Huh. There's an awful lot of them say that, and there's an awful lot of well-known scientists, in fact, love music.
Yeah.
I'm actually thinking that there's a band that Joe Ledoux runs. Mm-hmm. Dan Levitin has written a wonderful book on music, two books on music. Oliver Sacks has done this musicophilia and is devoted to music and so on. In a sense, it's this question is redundant with you,
right.
I suppose. If you hadn't been a scientist, you'd have been a musician? Maybe not.
Yeah, I don't know if I could. I love music. But I don't know. I mean, I'm not actually a performer. I would say I just like making things. I like making songs.
Well, you're on YouTube.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's right. I can jump around and I can goof around. It's true. Actually, maybe I should take that back. But I don't necessarily love the embracing the performance. I actually like the being the behind. I might have been a producer. I think I would have more likely have been a producer.
You're not trying to tell me you're shy now, are you?
You know, it's funny. I'm repeating myself because I feel, but I enjoy watching other people be awesome than
right.
try myself to do a good. I started doing music because I liked making videos and I wanted to make songs that I could do videos to. I like putting other people in front of the camera. It's actually, yes, I'm not shy. I'm happy to be in front of a camera, but what I get the most excited about is when I see other people doing things that are great and pulling great things out of other people. So I like doing science. I'm so happy now to watch my students do science and be a mentor. That's my real excitement, is when they come to me and we've been working on something and it comes through. I made a lot of videos when I was in medical school as well, and I just spent all this time, and everyone, I always say, like, you should be a star. I'm gonna put you into a scene. And for me, that's the most fun thing. So I think I would have been a director probably if I was for my name.
So you have a lab.
Yes.
You are a mentor. You're queen to a number of people.
I don't know. Queen would not be the right word, but yes.
Right. So
mama, apparently. Yes.
Mama. All right. So, did you ever imagine? Is this what you imagined, or
that my life would be?
Do you look back and think, wow?
I actually think I don't know how I got here. I probably, and again, actually, the other thing I probably would have been if I wasn't doing this kind of science is I'd probably be a doctor, which is what I thought I was going to be. And I have an MD and all of that, and was going to be just a medical doctor. But along the way, I just got really excited about research. And so it's not where I expected to be, but it's actually I found exactly what I want to do in my life. I found a job in which I do everything. I get to do the research. I get to teach others. I get to, within my own lab, and participate in their research education. But I also teach students in the undergraduates and graduate students. I run a clinic or a diagnostic facility in Nigeria, and I work with all the staff there and train Nigerians. And then I'm in a band, and everyone seems to be happy about that. So I think that all of that is just—it's the greatest job ever, right? The fact that all of that is actually part of the picture that makes my professor role is spectacular.
There's a couple of books. One's called Advice to a Young Scientist by Sir Peter Medawar, who was a great immunologist, as you know. And then Ramon y Cajal, Advice to a Young Investigator. Mm-hmm. Having been through some of this process now, and you're being in a mentor role now, mm-hmm. given what you've been through, do you have advice for young scientists, younger scientists?
I do. You have to have a sense of humor. That's the big one. You have to not mind failure. You have to embrace it. I think the big thing that I can tell anybody, that the advice that I would say to anyone, is just love failure. It's fun. It's fine. It's great. Once people actually have a success, you know that they are always like the thing they like to talk about is the failures that they've had. I've had many. And honestly, that's what makes it worth it. If it was just somehow like I just immediately got lucky with something and it was very easy, I don't think it'd be nearly as satisfying as all when you can look back and say like 10 times it totally failed. There's nothing wrong with that. It's the process you should enjoy. So you should do a job that you enjoy. That's the way to know what job you love, is the job that you enjoy, even if it's not successful, even in the failures. But embrace the failures, because they're going to be what your greatest successes are the foundation for them. So to me, I think that well too many people get immediately discouraged when they have a failure, because in this society, I think that's, people fear that. And you shouldn't fear it. I've had plenty of failures, and I really embrace them.
So what do you think was the biggest mistake, the biggest disappointment then, and what did you learn from it?
I should have a better answer to that. I mean, I'll do things like I failed my boards in medical school, actually, one time, because I took on like 3 papers I was working on and didn't study at all. And thought I was bold and could, and everyone kept telling me, oh, you can do everything. So I said, oh, sure I can. And I didn't think I could. I thought I really shouldn't take this, and I should reschedule, reorganize myself. And I didn't, and I worked on these papers. And actually that HLA SNP map was one of the papers I was working on, and did the entire week that I had, at the end, given myself just a week to study, and I spent the entire week working on figures, and I failed it. And so I deserve to fail it, but it feels good to know, yes, I'm actually, you can't do everything, you just can't, and you make choices. So don't try to tell yourself that you're going to do everything. Just know exactly what you can do and what you can't. That's one, but I have a whole array of these kinds of things where it's just mistakes made by people. Actually say that, if you're not riding on the edge of failure, then you're not doing it right anyway, that's actually meaning that you're pushing the boundary. But that failure is not glorious in any way. It's just a complete lack of time management.
And, achievement you're most proud of at this point? What do you think?
What achievement am I most proud of? There's not a one. There's not a one. I'll give one that actually is not.
Well, you don't have to give one.
Oh, okay. If I was to give an achievement.
It's kind of a cheesy question, but what I meant was.
I'll give one, like, you know, one that actually, one of the things that is a random thing that I'm most proud of is something called the freshman. So when I was at MIT, there was no orientation. There was no real orientation. When you got here, everybody got together. They did this kind of ropes corpsey thing for like 3 hours, and then you just fell into college. And actually, one of the first things that happens is you get rushed for fraternities and sororities. And it ends up kind of being a good idea, and everybody likes it because there's all these activities that school's starting. But the why it's be happening is not the right reasons. Essentially, you're judging people and deciding whether or not they should live with you or not, or if they're basically cool enough to live with you, or however that is. And so what I noticed that kept happening was that this whole process would happen, and all of these people would be judged. A lot of these students basically came, and they were their dorks in their high school because they did math and all this kind of stuff. And they did as I did, which was come to this new place and envision they were going to change their whole lives. And, you know, basically when you start college, it's such a transformative period that whatever happens to you will stay with you forever. You know, the memories are going to be very rich. And basically Rush would essentially bring them here, and for a vast majority of them, somebody was going to reject them within the first week that they were at MIT and tell them that indeed they still were not cool enough to be part of this fraternity at MIT. Anyway, so it really upset me. And also, because that segregation was into these different units was happening in the first week, it kind of propagated a lot of racial lines and all sorts of things that I didn't like. I loved MIT, but that was one thing I didn't particularly like. So I started this orientation program where I did it on my own with the help of the dean. Actually, they helped me think about how to do this, and basically said part of the thinking was do it on your own. Just do it outside of the school, but we'll let you mail and send something out to the students. So essentially, I invited every freshman. I basically got on a mailer, invited every freshman to come to this campsite in the middle of the woods for a week. And in that year, I actually was not able to get the mailing list until July or something, so I mailed all these students in July. They were coming in the middle of August. And 85 freshmen decided to come. And we had this thing called the Freshman Leadership Program, which is a week-long thing that I organized. And all my friends were the counselors and all this kind of stuff. But we did a week where we spent a week really going through issues of race, because I had done a lot of work with the National Conference of Christians and Jews on race relations. We did a lot of race activities. We did community building, leadership activities. And we just spent a lot of time getting the freshmen to know each other and feel empowered to embrace and take advantage of their freshman year and become something. And it's a very random accomplishment, but essentially, to me, it was exactly what I would want to be defined by, which is that all of these freshmen got to campus. They immediately all became involved in every attribute of campus. They all went into their own fraternities, but they all knew each other and started linking across it. And suddenly, the freshman class became very small. Everyone knew everybody because they all made their own friends, and then their friends became friends with their friends, and they were very activated. And since that, and now basically more than half of the class every year, this has become a part of the institutional policy. Everyone does all these they're called pre-orientation programs, but they come and participate in whatever they want to. I get emails being like, you're the founder, and there's a very collective excitement about the program. They call them FLP for life. There's a culture behind it, but it's a culture of empowerment, of getting the students to know each other, be excited about their freshman year, excited about what they can do in college, and activated. And, you know, to me, that's what I like the most, is, like I said, watching other people go the extra mile. And so I think that was one of the most exciting things I'd ever done.
Interesting you mentioned the emphasis on race there. Mm-hmm. You do genetics.
Yeah.
We're looking at stories here about still evolving after 10,000 years.
Yeah.
We're looking at a cover of Science magazine mm-hmm. recently about out of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Are we still evolving issue mm-hmm. gets straight at the heart of whether you can realistically and sensibly talk about races mm-hmm. as such. does this impact you? Do you think about this at a?
I mean, I don't actually. So personally, I don't really get into the genetics of race or any of those kinds of issues. I mean, you know, what you see in genetics is that race is there's an importance to it, sort of medically, as far as like pharmacology and things like that. But it is so. I mean, the human population separated so recently in time that we are by far more alike than we're not alike. And that especially actually when we evolved, one of the biggest things, if you look in the genome, as to what has changed in the human genome, probably the biggest thing that changed was just skin color, going, and it has to do with just sunlight and likely vitamin D and folate and just response to sunlight. That actually, and also things like hair and sweat, physical attributes are the ones that are most likely to change between populations when they go to different environments, because what's driving our evolution mostly is what's on the outside. And David Altshuler told me, actually, when I found the results that I did, he said, it's really nice because you can kind of say race is skin deep and evolution is skin deep. And that's really, you find that one of the biggest things that changes are the outside, but that actually is quite meaningless. It just means we wanted a little more, you know, vitamin D absorption.
You mentioned physical attributes. Of course, there is a school of thoughts. Some evolutionary psychologists have argued, in fact, that, and this article quotes some folks at the Center for Evolutionary Psychology at UC Santa Barbara, that our modern skulls house a Stone Age mind. In other words, that there hasn't been any cognitive development, evolution since the Pleistocene. Mm-hmm. This, on the other hand, is saying that we're still evolving. That, you know, that's not. I mean, do you think about those issues? Do you get into those issues at all?
I mean, I do. We have to be prepared to find whatever we find and embrace it and not worry about it. I don't study that myself. I don't know what would come of it. I just don't know. There is no real evidence in either side now. Our tools are not very well developed enough to find everything that exists. But none of the evidence that's been shown so far has really held up. So there's really no evidence in either direction about brain genes being, you know, lots and lots of evidence about skin color changing and lots of evidence about metabolic things changing, but not so much about the brain. But if it does come up, you know, we'll as a community have to be ready to embrace that as well. But it's not my area of research and it's not my interest.
Yeah. Do you still have family in Iran? Is that a major factor in your life as well? Do you look at what's happening there and here and think,
So it's very important to me. My Iranian culture and my Iranian heritage is very important to me because I left during a revolution and because it was a very tense time. My entire family left. A few of them were left behind, but everyone one by one came out. So I don't really have ties. I have distant family, but I don't. But pretty much my entire extended family is in either the U.S. or Europe. As far as that goes, not so much. But the Iranian community in America is very, very large, very active, and especially in L.A., right, and elsewhere. So I've become, actually more recently as an adult, become very excited to participate. One great thing I can say about Iranians, actually, that ties back to what we talked about before, was I give talks now to different Iranian groups, and it's funny to me because whenever I, you know, and I suddenly thought, oh my God, I appreciate this a lot, is that, you know, I get announced and people say I'm in a band and all this kind of stuff, and no one really cares. No one really cares about the band or any of that kind of stuff. But then they say I graduated from Harvard and with honors, and they erupt in applause like you've never seen. Especially the parents are just like cheering as if, you know, nothing you've ever seen, but everybody's erupting in applause. And it just dawned on me that is something that's very special about Iranian culture and others, many other cultures and other places, but about my culture I'm very proud of, is that the thing that they're the most proud of me about is that I graduated from medical school and I graduated with honors from medical school. It is a culture that is very obsessed with education, and that's a very important part of it, and that's something I greatly embrace about my culture.
Are you any interested in the history of science and so on and so forth? I mean, mm-hmm. I mentioned this as Darwin's year. Here's a little fun question. Mm-hmm. If you had a chance to sit down and have dinner with anybody in history? I mean, what kind of people would you like to sit down and ask questions of?
Well, I've always been really fascinated with Michelangelo. So, Leonardo da Vinci. I think actually a lot of the artists of the early time are fascinating to me. I mean, Leonardo da Vinci very much so for being, you know, on that edge of science and everything. But even Michelangelo, the paintings that they make, the way that they think about the human form, I've always been really fascinated by, and the artists of that time.
Have you ever tried painting?
My mother is a painter, but I am myself not much of a painter. But I have an appreciation for them, and so I actually think that, you know, people who are creative are the people who excite me the most. So it's not necessarily the people in history that have been the most powerful that I really want to learn from. It's the people who I just am awed by their, what their inventions and what they've produced and what they've created. So, yeah, and I would say actually, and other people I think would be, well, so Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci would probably be my top person that I would love to meet for many reasons. And then I would love to do a round table with Darwin and Wallace, actually, which would be, I'm for a long time I was incredibly fascinated with Wallace, actually, and really loved his early works and his story and the work that he did in Malaysia. So I actually ended up writing a play about Darwin and Wallace while I was at Oxford. It's the kind of thing you can do while you're at Oxford and what you should do while you're in Oxford. So I wrote a play about the history of the two papers and some of the contention around it. Basically it was a lot about how the contention around wanting precedence in this paper and wanting to be remembered was an off play by creating evolution in a way they were destroying religion and destroying heaven and immortality through heaven and all of that kind of concept. And so it was the idea of the now desire to get immortality through fame and through your papers and what might have all going on there for them.
Yeah, I think there's a saying, which you would probably know, that the reward of a scholar is that his lips shall move from the grave. Because you've left the work.
This is true.
Interestingly enough,
that's the thing, right? Darwin was afraid that essentially he was afraid of the religious implications and taking away religion. And now you would say that of all people, he's probably one of the most immortal. He has himself created his immortality through his work.
Although Wallace, as you recall, one of the problems was that he became so much involved, so entranced by psychical research and so on. So
that's true. So I think that's one of the one places where he was an interesting character with a lot of great ideas. What's interesting about both of them is that they are still a product of their time, and a lot of things that now we might think are ridiculous at the time. They were such incredible thinkers that we have to, you know, not hit them by the random things that they work on.
Do you think about the intersection of science and religion? I mean, one of the programs that the Science Network does is this meeting called Beyond Belief, and the first one, Neil Tyson and Richard Dawkins were in fact both there, and so on. So, is this something that you think about much?
Well, I get asked about a lot, so then I end up thinking about, but. And I do think about it, actually. And in fact, I have an interesting history because essentially we were pushed out of the country that we were in because of a revolution that was a fundamentalist revolution. And so there's a lot of antagonism to religion because of that, because of just the negative implications about what the religious leaders in our country did to the country. So, so there's some kind of ill will against religious fundamentalism that comes from a lot of people that left the revolution. But my mom actually, as soon as we got to the States, started having my sister and I go to a Presbyterian church. She wanted us to get engaged. You know, she wanted us to get engaged in the community, and we actually went to a Presbyterian church for a long time. And generally, I've grown to have a strong appreciation for religion when used the right way. The community that was built there and the excitement around what they were doing is beautiful. That there's a lot of just beautiful things that religion does, and there's a lot of community service activities that come from that. And so, in the conversations that I've had, I say that the thing that I want people to know, I am not against religion, and I think it's a beautiful thing, and I don't have that belief system, but religion and science is actually behind the same, they have the same goal and the same pursuit, which is to give meaning to the world and to understand the world. And one is through very, you know, through really a deep investigation of one book, and the other one is an investigation of a lot of different things going, phenomenon in the world. But essentially, I like all religious people, I'm trying to seek meaning and to understand how things came to be. And I just pursue it in a very different way. And even though I definitely stand by science, and I think that it has a lot to offer, I do think that one thing that we should, as a society should think about is that as we take away, what I do like about religion is the community that it brings, and the fact that you know, an entire community centered around a church, and the idea that they do, that most people, good people in religion, are talking about community service, and that sort of coming together on Sunday and thinking about how to be a better person, I think that that is a beautiful thing. And if we decide, I don't want to go so whole hog against religion that I take that away. And that if we decide that we're actually going to become a more scientific society, then we have to think about how to bring those beautiful aspects of religion to bear in the community.
You said that you don't get deeply into politics, science and politics. The president, in his inaugural address, I'm nevertheless going to ask you this, said that he wanted to restore science to its rightful place, and he mm-hmm. spoke about that at the National Academies as well. Mm-hmm. I've been asking a number of people what they think as we approach the year 2010, which mm-hmm. is the 350th anniversary of the foundation of the Royal Society, mm-hmm. it's a long-running science business yeah. right there. What is the rightful place of science?
I mean, there's a rightful place for a lot of things. There's a rightful place for music. There are things that, you know, what it brings to the society. There's a rightful place for a lot of different, any activity that's creating something. But I think, I guess, when you think about science, I just think about what it's created in the society, how much we take for granted, everything around that we use. You know, it's even funny because, you know, religion, religious leaders do all of their work on television, which was developed by scientists, and so there's a lot of things where you say, okay, you know what, you can attack, but you need to appreciate what it brings, and that essentially, as I said, there's so many different fields. There's just ways that human beings can be good to others and creative and produce things that are good in the world, and I think that science has just done a lot of tremendous things, and most of us would not be here if it wasn't for science. That, you know, smallpox or polio or something may well have taken us out of the gene pool a long time ago. So when we go to the doctor and we ask for a drug and we know that it's been studied in a wide genetic study, we need to appreciate, what it does for us. So I think that is it. I think it's just, question it, as we should all question whatever we do, but appreciate all of the sort of immeasurable ways in which it's helping you and enhancing the quality of your life.
Okay, so where do you think you'll be in another couple of decades? Would you still doing science?
No. Yeah. I'll be doing science. Yeah, for sure. I love it. In different ways. Obviously, now even just becoming a professor changes the way that you interact. But I love science. If I in two decades was a professor, at Harvard or another institution doing the exact same thing, I'd be really happy. The great thing about being a professor at an institution like this is that maybe your job description does not change, but the job is a moving target, where what the scientific discovery you're after is changing every year. So I think I would have the same job description, but a very different job.
Be a slightly aging rock star at that point as well.
Yeah, it would have to actually, reconsider. I would again try to write songs that I would try to pitch to younger musicians.
It's been fun talking to you. Pardee Savidi, thank you very much.
Thank you.